Don, where does this whole story start?
It begins in the fall of 2019. Demoris D. Smith, who's the head of the National Football League Players Union, is going into team locker rooms, as he does every fall, to meet with players, bring them up to date on what's happening. This time, he's really trying to rally the rank and file for the upcoming CBA negotiations.
Don Van Natta is an investigative reporter for ESPN.
He knows the owners want to expand the regular season from 16 to 18 games, and Smith is repeatedly telling players in every locker room, hell no on 18 games. No way we're going to agree to that in the name of player safety. But a few months later, some players say they are extremely surprised to learn that D. Smith had essentially begun negotiations with owners at 17 games in the regular season. And in a conference call in December 2019, Richard Sherman asks Smith point blank if 17 games was non-negotiable. And D. Smith says yes. This shocks many players. It's this action by D. Smith and many actions prior to that one that have many people around the league now, including player leaders, wondering if D. Smith is an asset to management instead of the players. One owner told me, if we could, every owner would build a statue to D outside their stadiums. That's how good he's been for our business. So we really started there in looking at D. Smith and his legacy as leader of the NFLPA.
When the NFL reached a new 10-year collective bargaining agreement with its players last March, it should have been this defining moment for NFLPA Executive Director Demoris Smith. Instead, some players, and even some owners, have come to see Smith as an asset to the very group he's meant to oppose, NFL management. Today, ESPN's Don Van Natta digs deep into the tenure and track record of one of the most powerful people in sports today. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Tuesday, February 23rd. This is ESPN Daily. Hey, Don, thanks so much for joining us, man.
Thank you, Pablo. Great to be with you.
We're here to talk about your latest piece, which is a doozy. It is one you reported alongside Seth Wickersham. You worked on it for months and even years, and it's a deep dive into Demoris Smith, who is easily one of the most important, influential, powerful people in not just pro football, but American sports at large. But he's also, Don, someone that I feel like people may not know a ton about, especially if you're just a casual sports fan. D. Smith is the executive director of the NFLPA. That's the players' union that represents the athletes in the NFL, which is self-evidently important. But I want to ask you just to start here, what made you interested in D. Smith in the first place? Why'd you want to report on that guy?
Well, as you said, Pablo, he is one of the most influential people in all of sports and not very well known. He's a behind-the-scenes operator. I met D. Smith back in 2012 as I was reporting an in-depth profile of NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, and I was really struck at how outspoken he was against Goodell, against the owners, and yet at the same time was coming off a CBA that the owners seemed pretty satisfied about. So there seemed even back then a disconnect between D. Smith's public statements and the way the owners viewed him. So I really wanted to do what I did with Roger Goodell back in 2013, an in-depth investigative portrait, really looking at a report card of his 12 years of leadership. How good has he been for the players, and how do his adversaries, the owners, view him?
So before we get into the report card, I want to understand just how this guy became the head of the NFLPA. How did he rise to power in the first place?
Well, he came out of nowhere. He was a complete outsider back in 2009. He was a 45-year-old partner in Patton Boggs, a Washington, D.C. white shoe law firm. He had no experience in sports business or labor law, but he was recruited by former Washington defensive end Charles Mann to run for the NFLPA executive director job. In Hawaii in March of 2009, D dazzled the player reps. He said he would use every bullet in his gun against owners in the upcoming CBA negotiations, and he won unanimously.
My name is Damaris Smith. I represent the players of the National Football League. I represent the retired players of the National Football League. I represent every player in the National Football League.
So he came in as a complete outsider and surprised everybody when he won the top job.
He ends up succeeding the legendary union leader Gene Upshaw, a former player, a man of great renown who died in 2008. What kind of legacy did Upshaw leave behind? What was D. Smith walking into as his predecessor is concerned?
Well, Gene Upshaw was very close with Commissioner Paul Tagliabue. Upshaw came up with a deal that was extremely good for the players in the 2006 CBA. And, you know, on one of Smith's first days at work, he opened the desk drawer of his Washington office and he found a handwritten speech. It had been written by Gene Upshaw. And D read the speech. It was written over two columns in neat black ink, and it really felt like a talisman to D. Smith. And there was a line there that jumped out at D. Smith that Gene Upshaw had written. Owners will always take a short-term loss for a long-term gain. Basically, the owners are willing to sacrifice a few dollars today to make $100 tomorrow.
So there are billions of dollars on the line in each of these negotiations, as always. D. Smith gets the job in 2009, and at that point, Don, the CBA, the collective bargaining agreement between the players and the league, is expiring just 2 years later in 2011. So leading up to those 2011 negotiations, what was the state of mind of the league and the owners at that point?
Oh, they wanted to kill. They wanted revenge after the 2006 CBA, which had lavished players with up to 57.5% of total revenues. Some owners thought it was as high as 59%. So they wanted to roll back that share significantly. And we had a source, one of the league negotiators, say basically this was going to be a street fight to see who could hurt the players worse, although he uses a four-letter word much stronger than hurt. And the owners were prepared. And the way D. Smith saw it in our interview that Seth Wickersham and I did with D., the way he viewed it was he was not an equal to Roger Goodell. D. says that Goodell grew up in the NFL. He grew up understanding the levers of power. And Smith says flatly, we weren't equals.
So Goodell, who was a protege of the previous commissioner, who was this lifer in the league, who was savvy about all of this. Could you remind us, Don, like just how these things tend to go? Because players versus owners, I mean, that's this very classic, totally zero-sum proposition, right?
It is. And Roger Goodell knew that it wasn't an equal playing field, that the owners always have the benefit of time. Mm. Players have very little time. The average career is 2.5 years. And D. Smith knew that going in as well. And so he was on his back heels. And that sense of trying to get revenge really motivated the owners. They did not want to give more than 50% of their revenue pie to players any longer. They were going to do everything they could in those negotiations to roll that back significantly.
So the league and the owners, who, as you say right there, are in power in pretty much perpetuity, and the union of players who are cycling out in these roughly 3 to 4 year kind of deals, on average, they set a deadline of mid-March to come to an agreement. What happens?
Well, D turns down a deal that, from the owner's perspective, was pretty good and turned out to be, by their perspective, $1 billion better than what D would ultimately settle for. There's this incredible moment where Jerry Jones goes to his fellow owners after D turns down this initial offer and tells this crazy anecdote about owls and chickens. Look, my daddy grew up on a farm in southwest Missouri. Every so often in the spring, the wind would come from a different part of the country and the moon would set a different way and the owls would start having relations amorously with the chickens. nobody knew where he was going with this story, and he said it again, and he said it makes no sense that they turned this offer down, but it's a great thing for us. Jerry had the foresight to realize that when D. Smith turned down that initial offer before the lockout, that it was going to be really good for owners, maybe to the tune of about $1 billion.
So D. Smith and the players, they turned down the owner's offer, and the owners, Don, in turn, they begin a lockout that lasts for over 100 days, extending into the summer as they're hammering out this new deal. What other issues were being negotiated?
The owners wanted to expand the regular season, and this isn't widely known. They had the unilateral right under the CBA from 2006 that Gene Upshaw struck with Paul Tagliabue to do that. Players were adamantly opposed behind closed doors. And there's this wonderful moment where Dominique Foxworth, our colleague now, who was a member of the executive committee of the union back then,
yes,
goes toe-to-toe with Jerry Richardson over this very situation.
I mean, this is one of my favorite things that I think anyone has ever reported, Don, to be perfectly frank with you. Can you give us the accounting, the rundown of what that exchange actually entailed? Because Jerry Richardson at the time is the owner of the Carolina Panthers.
Yes, and Jerry Richardson is telling the players, we want a 17th game. And he is reminding everybody that under the terms of the CBA, they could actually go to 18 games without the union's approval. Dominique Foxworth tells Jerry Richardson, we're not playing 17 games, Jerry. It's not going to happen. Jerry Richardson sits straighter up in his chair and says, we can make you. We don't have to ask you. We're being nice by not saying, F you, you have to do it. To which Dominique replies, we're being nice by not telling you, F you, we're not playing. Jerry responds, we're being nice by not telling you, F you, we'll play with replacement players. To which Dominique says, we're being nice by not telling you, F you, good luck filling up stadiums with Ryan Leaf at quarterback.
Honestly, it explains my friendship with Dominique so much better than I ever understood it before. But Don, what was the end result of the lockout?
Well, the end result is that D. Smith was able to get a reduction in practice time during the offseason in particular, although our reporting shows that that's something that the owners were likely going to give away anyway because they were very concerned about the concussion optics at that time. The biggest thing that D. Smith was able to do was to get the owners to agree that if they were going to expand the regular season, they needed union consent, whether it went to 17 games or 18 games. But from the owner's perspective, this was a monumental, fantastic deal. First of all, it was 10 years, which is unheard of that unions ever agree to a 10-year deal. You know, the NBA is 7 years with an opt-out at 5. MLB is 5 years. It's just completely unheard of. And then it established a lopsided salary cap that rewarded franchise players with generational wealth, but really squeezed the large middle class in a way that owners were quite happy about. And what happened with rookie salaries also worked to kind of push down the salaries of really the rank and file players. And then finally, 47% of the revenues is what D. Smith and the union agreed to, which is an enormous clawback and haircut when you consider it was 57.5% under the deal struck by Gene Upshaw. There was an adversary of Smith, the former player Sean Gilbert, who estimated that $10 billion would be shifted from the players to the owners during the deal's decade. And a league executive told Wickersham and me that the 2011 CBA amounted to, in the sports world, the biggest transfer of wealth of the 21st century.
Coming up, how Demoris Smith has managed to keep his position of power in the middle of the most popular sport in America.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
So, Don, it seems like the general consensus coming out of the 2011 CBA negotiation was that it did not turn out well for the NFL players and for Dee Smith. They had turned down the first deal, they had forced the lockout, and they ultimately ended up accepting this lesser deal. But in 2011, despite all of that, Dee Smith still receives a $1 million bonus. What are the details behind that? Why did that happen?
Well, this is really interesting. Dee Smith was not pleased with his pay package when he became the NFLPA executive director. He actually worked for about 6 months without a salary. And the members of the union's executive committee gave him a salary much less than what Gene Upshaw was paid, millions of dollars less, actually. The executive committee are the bosses of Dee Smith. They are the most influential players. They're the ones that sort of have oversight of the union. They're really the power center. And Dee is really, as executive director, working for their pleasure. So the 11-member executive committee decided in November of 2011 to consider a $1 million bonus for Dee Smith. But this was a very contentious issue. Scott Vegeta and Charlie Batch were opposed to it, saying that Dee's performance in the CBA negotiations didn't warrant a bonus. But Drew Brees and some other members of the executive committee pushed for it, and Dee Smith got the $1 million bonus anyway.
So the name, the boldface name in all of this, as you just said, is Drew Brees. What did you find in your investigation about Brees and his role within that executive committee?
Well, one of the things that was really striking is just how outspoken Drew Brees was among all of his peers on any union business. He was very conspicuous in his support of Dee Smith, but also very conspicuous in his criticism of Roger Goodell, particularly on the issue of player discipline.
I think we would all agree he definitely has too much power, that he is basically judge, jury, executioner when it comes to all league discipline.
Now, obviously, he had a dog in that fight, right, with Bountygate. Mm-hmm. But even on Deflategate and on other issues, he would criticize Goodell, saying he was, you know, judge, jury, and executioner. He was always the person most out there, most outspoken on any of this union business, and always seemed to be backing Dee Smith.
What theories did people involved have as to why Brees was that outspoken?
Well, there were some executive committee members back in the timeframe of about 2012 to 2013 that noticed large payments in the union's own public filings to the Labor Department going to Drew Brees for executive committee work, in some years as high as $2 million. And as a point of comparison, the executive committee members noticed that Brees was making far more than any other executive committee member. Jeff Saturday and Dominique Foxworth, for instance, were making $10,000 or $15,000 a year for their work on the executive committee, while Brees had these $2 million figures in the same column. And these executive committee members asked union officials, what are these payments for? They were told they were for Players, Inc. That's the union's arm for endorsement money and appearances money, marketing money, things like that, similar to what any star players get. And they were told that the filings really were just reflective of money that Drew Brees would have gotten from Players, Inc., but because he was on the executive committee, those large multi-million dollar payments were in a different column. Now, that explanation was viewed skeptically by some union reps. It was also viewed very skeptically by Cyrus Mary, who is a civil rights lawyer who actually wanted to run against Dee Smith. Mary says to us on the record, when he found those Brees payments, it blew his socks off. Now, Pablo, we looked very hard at this issue. We sought outside expert opinions from people that are experts on these LM2 filings. We found no evidence of wrongdoing. Experts told us the paperwork was apparently filed legally. However, one of the foremost LM2 experts in the country told me, from a transparency issue, it's confusing to say the least, and Brees's agent has called all this a ministerial reporting issue. Dee Smith says that Brees was paid only this Players, Inc. money for appearances and endorsements. What D told me was being a union president or executive committee member is a volunteer position. You get $0, no salary, no stipend. So as D puts it, Drew Brees, when he was on the executive committee, happened to be at the height of his marketing powers, and therefore his combined equal share payment, licensing, royalty, and appearance fees were in the top 20 in the NFL. I mean, it literally is that simple.
So it is worth being very clear here, Don, that you found no evidence that there was anything improper in the payments to Brees. But at the same time, in general, what did Smith stand to gain from the support of a guy like Drew Brees?
Oh, it was enormously helpful to D. Smith to have somebody with the star power of Drew Brees being an outspoken proponent on union business, backing him up publicly, particularly in these very public fights against Roger Goodell on player discipline. It was extremely important to have somebody of Drew Brees' stature in your corner, and D. Smith knows that.
So, Don, as executive director of the NFLPA, D. Smith is up for re-election every 3 years. And in 2012, he successfully re-elected. In 2015, it's a different situation. He encounters a group of challengers who attempt to prevent his re-election. What happened there?
Well, there were eight challengers, and at a meeting in Hawaii, it was, as one union executive told me, a clown show. It was people questioning every aspect of D. Smith's leadership, and it was really probably the most imperiled D. was in keeping his job. He narrowly won another three-year term, but at the same meeting, there were members of the executive committee and others that set out to amend the union constitution on how the union hires and decides whether to keep its executive director. And so a 14-member selection committee was created. And interestingly, though, it wasn't known right away. This was approved, but it took months for anybody to figure it out.
So essentially, Don, they changed the union constitution so that this new 14-member selection committee, if they vote unanimously to extend D. Smith's term, he doesn't actually have to run for re-election and nobody can challenge his seat. How was that rule change perceived by the people who opposed D. Smith?
Well, they were furious about it. They were extremely suspicious, first of all, of why it happened. And then when it did happen, it wasn't made public for months on the NFLPA website. So they were crying foul about transparency, and they just felt it was unfair. They felt the system was rigged against anybody who wanted to try to even get on the ballot to run against D. Smith. And then even if they do get on the ballot, you know, can they unseat him? And so job for life was the charge that was thrown around by Cyrus Mary and some of his supporters, some NFL Hall of Famers and others that feel that D. Smith is not up to the job, all felt this was wrong and unfair and was done to keep D. in the job as long as he wants to keep it.
So let's recap at this point, Don, because we know that D. Smith now has this very mixed reputation. On the one hand, he is this strong advocate, a vocal advocate for player safety. And some players, even the prominent stars, as we've discussed, they are continuing to defend D. Smith. But on the other side of the aisle, he is making moves that are amassing power that make it more difficult to challenge and unseat him. And at the same time, during his tenure here, and this feels important to point out and clarify, team valuations, how much these franchises are worth, they have only gone up. While the salary cap, the pool of money that players can draw from, that's increased only modestly. So what do the owners here, Don, his real adversaries in this world, what do they think of D. Smith?
Well, many of them see him as an asset. They see him as an ally. They feel as if he is in that job and it is good for them. They were pleased that they were going to be able to face him when the 2020 CBA came up. To your point, Pablo, about team valuations, they have skyrocketed. If you look at the Dallas Cowboys, they've gone up $4.5 billion during the course of the first CBA to a record $6.5 billion. Now, union officials will tell you it's not fair to look at team valuations, but the team valuations are a reflection of revenues and of and of value, and the revenues have improved exponentially during the first CBA. So from the owner's perspective, they see D. Smith as somebody that they feel as if they rolled in 2011 and felt they could roll him again in 2020.
Up next, the 2020 CBA negotiations, a pandemic, and a vote that comes down to the wire.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
So, Don, I want to circle back now to that story you were telling me at the very top of the podcast, which is that in 2020, despite all of these player concerns, D. Smith walks into negotiations with the owners for the next CBA, essentially with the understanding that the 17 games isn't really up for debate. The owners had to have that, even though D. Smith and the players had negotiated the right to essentially veto that kind of a move in 2011. And even though the players themselves, they clearly did not want the 17th game. So if that's the backdrop here, Don, why did D. Smith accept the expansion of the regular season so willingly, even when players opposed it?
Well, I don't think he was provided with much of a choice. I think in August of 2019, when the NFL owners gave the proposal for the next CBA, 17 games was non-negotiable. And as we talked about earlier, Pablo, the players have limited leverage, and I think D. Smith knew that. Now, one of the disconnects here is there are quite a few players that feel as if D. was not outspoken enough on this particular point and accepted it far too willingly. But I think from D.'s perspective, he really didn't have much choice. And also, D. would tell you, it's really up to the players ultimately whether they're going to accept this or not. He doesn't have a vote.
So in February of 2020, Don, the owners overwhelmingly approved the new CBA with the 17th game attached, as you described it. The next day, though, after the owners approve this thing, what happens?
Well, the executive committee rejects the deal, basically because they're opposed to the 17th game. And a firestorm is created on Twitter.
How about Russell Wilson? Here's what the Seahawks quarterback tweeted today. Quote, the NBA and MLB are doing it right. Players come first. All NFL players deserve the same. We should not rush the next 10 years for today's satisfaction. I vote no, end quote.
You have members of the executive committee and other player leaders, Russell Wilson, Aaron Rodgers, J.J. Watt, Richard Sherman, all voicing strong opposition to the deal. And for D. Smith, this is a disaster.
I remember that day when all the stars suddenly started speaking out about this. It was strange. It was chaotic. And as a result of that outcry, as you report, the union vote, it turns out, gets moved from that group of the executive committee and the player reps to now all the players in the league. But it is also happening right as the pandemic is about to hit us in March, which greatly affects, obviously, everything that is being negotiated. So what happens on that front?
When the pandemic hits, the players are in the midst of voting. And there were some players that were actually asking, well, maybe we should delay this vote. They were told no. Interestingly, Pablo, practice squad players who, of course, want their money right now were also voting. 500 players didn't even bother to vote because they were distracted most likely by the pandemic. And finally, the new CBA does pass, but barely.
Breaking news this morning on SportsCenter. The CBA has passed. The NFL players have approved the new deal. And here's how close the vote was. 1,019 to 959. A difference of 60 votes.
Quickly, there's buyer's remorse from some players. Aaron Rodgers says publicly, I wasn't real happy about the way this thing went down.
Yeah, Rob, I wasn't real happy about the way things went down. I think the things that happened in Indy and the way that the vote went, yeah, I wasn't real excited about it. I wanted to get involved.
Eric Ebron tweets out, can't believe we agreed to that, LOL. And of course, at NFL headquarters at 345 Park Avenue and in owner's suites around the league, they're quite happy that this was passed because there is now certainty on labor for the next decade. And the owners can move on to those very lucrative broadcast rights contracts that they're now negotiating.
So I know on some level this is unknowable, Dom, the question I'm going to ask you here, but what does all your reporting tell you about what might have been different about these negotiations if there was not this pandemic?
It's a really good question. I think that one option would have been, as D. Smith said to players before the Super Bowl in Miami, look, we can strike. If we strike, that's always the most leverage that the players have. And we've seen how it's helped guaranteed contracts and salary levels in the NBA and Major League Baseball. But here, there's just never seems to be an appetite for it with the NFL. So there was a lot of public griping about the way this happened. But unless you're going to really push the nuclear button and go the route of a strike or some kind of work stoppage that will squeeze these young players out of their prime earning years, there's really not much that D. Smith can do at the end of the day.
Don, it's hard not to go back to that quote from Gene Upshaw that you'd mentioned earlier, that owners will always take a short-term loss for a long-term gain. I wonder whether this power dynamic can ever truly be a match of equals. I mean, football, by nature, is a sport where players have these short careers. They're always going to be incentivized to make money now in the present tense. Owners, though, they have the benefit of long-term time horizons. They basically run these teams for as long as they wish to. So is someone like D. Smith, is he in an unwinnable situation?
He probably is. It really comes down to leverage. It's always about leverage. And there is limited leverage. But, you know, what I set out to do with this story, Pablo, was to look at the sweep of D. Smith's leadership as head of the NFLPA for 12 years. And when he came in and he dazzled those guys at that first meeting when he was voted unanimously, he said he was going to use every bullet at his disposal against the owners. And the question now is whether he did or not. To be seen after a dozen years in the top job as an asset or an ally and have owners chortling that they're going to build a statue in your honor outside their stadiums. I mean, that's the grade, I think, that ultimately you have to look at D. Smith's leadership on is how his adversaries see him. And they don't see him as a big threat.
Don Van Natta, thank you for your reporting on one of the most influential people in American sports.
Thanks, Pablo. Appreciate it.
For more on D'Amora Smith's legacy as head of the Players Union, check out Don Van Natta and Seth Wickersham's piece, which is out today on ESPN.com. I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.